is this air? Should we use it?
Okay, we'll maybe I'll start because it's pretty hot. So yeah, very warm welcome to everyone. I've got this. Can you hear me?
Have you got my...
I have. Can you hear me? Should I push back?
Yeah.
Just about?
Just about.
Okay, I'll try and speak louder, so you'll need to remember this as well.
Watch where your hand is fitted up and your hand might be in front of the microphone.
Okay. Never used one of these before. Okay, so here we are gathered today. So we're, come on in. There's a cushion there, if you like one. And there's a seat at the back as well.
There's plenty of space.
Yeah, so very warm welcome to everyone. I know some of you have just got here and some of you have been here for the whole day. My name's Vidyadharka and Srivati is there. We've been co-leading the day together. And so it's lovely to see you all, lovely to see such a full shrine room. And what we'll be doing now, we've been hearing about the life of the Buddha and stories from the life of the Buddha, both personal and sort of mythical. And now Subhuti's arrived, and we're going to hear a talk from Subhuti. So most of you will know Subhuti, but maybe some of you who don't. So Subhuti is the president of the LBC. He's been the president for many years, I don't know how long. What that means is that Subhuti comes two or three times a year for a week, 10 days, and basically offers spiritual friendship to anyone.
Keep an eye on you as well.
And to keep an eye on those who need keeping an eye on. So I feel really, really grateful that Subhuti comes so regularly and gives so fully of himself when he is here. When he's here, you kind of know that he's here. He's got a lot of energy and puts a lot of it into meeting people and also talking and communicating the Dharma. For me, and as I'm sure it is for many of you, it's a real highlight of the year, sort of exceptional highlight of the year of the LBC calendar. So I'm really pleased that Subhuti's here, really pleased that he's here again. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, really good. So thank you for coming, and thank you for agreeing to give the Buddha Day talk. I know you don't officially give talks as such, you normally give rambles, so I was a little bit nervous about asking Subhuti to give a talk, but a talk he's going to give, I hope. He doesn't know what he's going to say, nor do I. So just a little bit about Subhuti. He was ordained in 1973, as far as I'm aware. So that's 1 year longer than all the years I've been alive. Sorry, 1 year shorter. So all my life, Subhuti has been in the order. Building institutions. He built the LBC, for example, and communicating the Dharma. And, a couple of qualities that I'm particularly notice when Subhuti's around, he's got an intense emotional positivity, very, very strong positive energy orientated towards the Dharma and towards connecting with others. Very, very strong emotional positivity and a really clear mind. When Subhuti gives his rambles, it's like he pulls ideas and concepts and thoughts and things that are sort of in the air, and he sort of pulls them together and is able to talk about concepts and the Dharma very, very eloquently, very, very clearly, and very, very sort of powerfully. And it's certainly in my mind, Subhuti has a very influential effect, very positive effect in our mandala when he comes to the centre. Of course, we're all partly enjoying the conditions that Sabuti helped set up many years ago when the LBC was built. So I know Sabuti was one of the main kind of builders of this physical space, which we've been coming along to for many, many years. So a lot of gratitude. And as I say, he's extremely generous when he comes to the centre, very, very generous in giving of his energy and time and love. And last year, the LBC Council went up to Sabuti's kind of cootie in North Wales, in the middle of, I don't know where it's in the middle of, anyway. In the middle of a vast range of mountains. I don't quite know where it is. When we were up there, it was fairly extreme conditions, and Sabuti had to get a few farmers to actually get us all out. But I was really struck when we were there just by Sabuti and his ability to host. Very, very loving and generous host to the 12 of us who were there. So, yeah, a lot to be grateful for. And, maybe that's enough. So Sabuti's kindly agreed to give the Buddha Day talk. Let's leave it to him and see what he says. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Vidyadharka. Brothers and sisters, very good to see the LBC Shrine Room packed on Buddha Day. You can imagine that people like me, who I was the first person from our movement who saw this space when it was just a deserted engine shed. Just in the middle of the floor there was a pit where they, inspected the bottom of the fire engines. And so you can imagine it's very satisfying to me to see now so many people gathered here and gathered in the presence of the Buddha, so to speak. Before I came into the room, I had a little talk with Srivati, and I said that I was thinking along two different lines and just asked her for her suggestions about which line I should talk along. I probably talk about something else completely, but anyway, she gave me her preference for which line I should talk along. And then she said she'd like to hear something about my own connection with the Buddha. So let me just start there and see where that takes me. I first encountered the Buddha when I was 8. My father was a captain in the Royal Navy, and he went off to rule the Seven Seas for 18 months. And when there was still somewhere to fly the flag, so to speak. And on his return, he had a sort of memorial volume, which was about the journey and the places they'd been. They'd been to Melbourne for the Olympics and to various Gulf states and so on, and to Burma, to Myanmar. Burma it still was then. And he showed me some, in that memorial volume, there's a picture of a Burmese Buddha image. And it was just the Buddha sitting in Bhumibhasha, in earth-touching position, with the kind of Southeast Asian pinnacle on the top of his head. And it made an instant impression on me. It wasn't a particularly good picture, I think, as far as I remember, but it was there in this memorial volume of sailors who'd just been around the world. And it made an immediate impression on me. My father talked a little bit more about it. One of his admirals had entered a Burmese monastery for a period, as my father said, to learn how to separate his body from his mind. at the time, I found this really intriguing. of course, being a young Englishman, I don't have any difficulty separating my body from my body. But in the sense that that it was talked of there, I find it absolutely intriguing. And these sort of little images from very early in my life had a lasting impact on me. I didn't follow it up at all until I went to university. I went to what is now the University of North London in Kentish Town, and I studied philosophy. I studied philosophy because I read the Socratic dialogues by Plato about the last days of Socrates, and I was riveted by the figure of Socrates, a truly wise individual, and one who believed that it was more important to stand with his principles than to live. He wasn't prepared to compromise for his principles. And I was also very, very struck by his relationship with his students, with his followers and friends. Very, very warm, very open, very loving, and also very challenging. He wouldn't let them get away with anything. But it made a strong impression on me. It was because I read that I decided to study philosophy. I'm afraid the actual study of philosophy, at least as it was studied in the college where I studied at that time, was dire. It was at the height of the influence of the Vienna crisis, the Vienna Circle and the logical positivists and A.J. Ayer. It's good philosophy, of course, but it's dry as dust. I remember we went to the dean of the faculty asking to study Eastern philosophy, and she said, no, you can't study Eastern philosophy, because what happens is people get emotionally involved. I didn't have the presence of mind to say, that's what I want. I want to get emotionally involved. So I'm afraid that although there were some wonderful highlights, and I'm very, very glad that I did study philosophy, it didn't really meet what I'd expected and what I wanted. I wanted a teacher. I wanted a life teacher, if you like. I didn't really know what I wanted, but I'd found something in the image of Socrates. And one night, under the influence of certain herbs, I was reading a book that was lying around. It was Evelyn Underhill's Mysticism, the classic of mysticism. And there are various things in there that made me realise that religion wasn't what I thought it was, or didn't need to be what I thought it was. It wasn't about belief in something that you just had to accept and didn't necessarily have any possibility of a real encounter with. And it was about the inner journey. And I mentioned how inspired I'd been by that, and the person in whose flat I'd found it said that, well, have you looked at other religions? So the next day I went out and I bought Bhagavad Gita, Upanishads, Quran, Tao Te Ching, etc., etc., and a book of Buddhist scriptures. It's the collection by Edward Conza, published it by Penguin as Buddhist Scriptures. And I won't tell you about my responses to the various books that I read, most of which I could make no sense of at all. I couldn't relate to, there's stuff to be got from them, but I couldn't get it at that time. But as soon as I started reading the Buddhist Scriptures, and especially the opening sections, which are taken from the Pali Canon and are incidents in the life of the Buddha, I instantly felt, this is what I've been looking for. This is sort of Socrates squared. I didn't think all this, if you see what I mean. It's only in retrospect that I can make that connection. But at the time, that is the sense that I had. I'd found a teacher. I'd found my teacher. And it was the image of his humanity. The image of his freedom. He just wandered freely. He wasn't contained by anything. He wasn't contained by material needs. His extraordinary clarity, even at that time I could see in the rather dry translation, I could see that the penetration of his intellect, or of his spiritual insight really, perhaps. And his warmth, the strong emphasis on Maitri and Karuna that comes through those texts, and later texts in the collection. And so the figure of the Buddha came to life for me, not in a very conscious way. I can now say that that happened. At the time, it was just there. And I found that the Buddha had moved into the centre of my life. And I knew I was a Buddhist. And I began to look for Buddhist teaching. To begin with, I wasn't that clear about the difference between Taoism and Buddhism and Hinduism and so forth. But really, it was Buddhism that I was attracted to, especially. So I found a teacher, Sangharakshita, Urgen Sangharakshita, the founder of our order, founded the centre, who performed the opening ceremony for this centre, gave it his blessings. And I worked very closely with him. And in many ways, for me, he, if I said took the place of the Buddha, that would be to put it rather wrongly. It was that he mediated the Buddha for me. I was in direct contact with him as a human being. I was his secretary. I was serving him. I was studying his teaching. I was practicing his teaching. And I knew that that teaching came from the Buddha. And so for me, the Buddha was sort of mediated by him. I wasn't always that clear, perhaps mistakenly. I wasn't that clear about the distinction between them, so to speak. I'd never thought of him as the Buddha, but I did think of him as the Buddha, if you see what I mean. So, yes, for me, he became the way in which I could approach the Buddha. I could think about the Buddha. From my knowledge of him, I could think of the Buddha, or feel the Buddha, as something even more, much more. Then, in 1985, I went for the first time to India. And from 1990, I've been going regularly every year. And over the last 15 years, I go for 6 months every year. I'm working there with our Tri Ratna brothers and sisters there, working to communicate the Dhamma in the Indian context, especially in the context of the rejection of the caste system and the rejection of the lowly status that so many who converted to Buddhism have in that system. So working closely with them. But it's the land of the Buddha. And being there, in that land, made the Buddha come to life for me far more than ever before. Because of the landscape, because of the people. They're the same features as the Buddha, the same colour as the Buddha, the same culture, essentially, as the Buddha, albeit 2,500 years later. And I felt often in, particularly going into people's homes, extremely hospitable and very, very gentle, natural hospitality. And it's a wonderful experience to be invited into a home of that kind, especially when people are extremely poor. They will give you everything, and sometimes it's quite embarrassing. You know that you don't need what they're giving you, as it were, but they want to give it to you because of their strong feeling to be hospitable, and especially if they know that you're a fellow Buddhist. And it was a remarkable experience which brought me much, much closer to the Buddha. For quite a long time, I didn't have time while I was in India to go to Buddhist sites. I was so busy with the work that we were doing, which is mainly in Western Maharashtra, Western India, Maharashtra, where, as far as we know, the Buddha never set foot, although Maharashtrians firmly believe he did. Eventually I did find my way to Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha gained enlightenment, the day that we're commemorating here. And I've been going to Bodh Gaya every year for the last 15 years, especially in the winter season. Although now I go every time I go to India. I cannot stay away from Bodh Gaya. It's the most awful place. I can't imagine a more sort of unpleasant... Well, no, I can. But it's dirty, it's chaotic, it's ruthlessly exploitative, because it's a tourist spot with many Westerners and many Asians from outside India coming there and who are fair game. It's... yeah, really not a pleasant place in certain respects. And I also, most of my immediate connections are with people from Dalit communities around Bodh Gaya, in and around Bodh Gaya. And I've never seen exclusion and poverty of that kind until I started associating with gypsies in Central Europe. It's different there, but it's sort of equivalent. Desperately poor people, terribly oppressed, a lot of violence, a lot of institutionalized oppression, and also a lot of dislocation from the all the monasteries of all these Asian Buddhists. You've got this terrible social situation. In the midst of it, you've got these very, very lavish monasteries with people coming from all over the world. There's no connection, very limited connection. And I find that, well, sort of distasteful and shocking. So it's in a certain sense, not a pleasant place. Maybe others have got different experience. But it's commercialized in a particular sort of Indian way, which is not easy to stomach. I mean, for instance, the commercialization of deformity and of poverty and so on, just is not easy to stomach. And then it's a tourist, it's a pilgrimage place, and strangely, Buddhist pilgrims, they're doing Bodh Gaya one day and then they're on to Rajgriha and somewhere else the next day. And they're pretty ruthless. You can get trampled in the rush as they do what they've got to do. It's tremendous devotion, but they're just doing what they've got to do. And yes, in many ways, it's not a very pleasant place. But when you go there and you sort of... uncurl your lip and your fingers, as it were, and relax into it. What I find is a very, very deep atmosphere. Very strange. This superficial chaos outside, extraordinary chaos. Inside, it's not so chaotic, but it's a lot of noise, there's people rushing here and there, parties, trying to keep up with their monk, loudspeakers all in opposition to each other. It's not a tranquil place, it's not like a shrine room or something like that, in the tourist season. But I've learned how to be there now. I've learned, for instance, not to fight the unpleasantness of it, not to try to pretend it's not there. To embrace it and to accept it and to allow my feelings to roll with it, so to speak, to see the suffering and to feel it and to see the insensitivities and recognize that behind them lies some need, if you see what I mean. So I've learned how to be in that way. And then when you come into the temple, I just start doing my own devotion and just bow at various places around the site. Trying to be as mindful of other people as I can. And then I find my way to the Bodhi tree. The temple is a 6th century construction, Gupta period, reconstructed by Alexander Cunningham, General Alexander Cunningham, the founder of the Archaeological Survey of India, who kind of rescued the site and has created the form in which it now presents itself. at the back of the temple, there's a tree which is a it's not even a descendant. It's the same genetic stock, as it were, as the original tree. So far as we know, there's documents sufficient to suggest that that is literally true. That the tree is the grand descendant of that original tree. And it's a magnificent tree. It's a huge tree, and it's quite old and even a little bit sick. But the tree just spreads over the whole of the back of the temple. And I always sit as close as I can to the tree. There's a railing around the tree, and at the back of the tree there's a slab put there by the Emperor Ashoka to mark the very spot where the Buddha gained enlightenment. So I press my nose as closely as I can against the railings and peer through at the roots of the tree, and I'm doing it now, I'm there now, at the slab which marks the spot where the Buddha sat and achieved this extraordinary revolution in human consciousness, in the dispensation of which we are meeting today. And I just gaze at it. It's hope. You can't do a practice. You try to do the mindfulness of breathing, you'll break your head. You can just about do the metta, because a lot of people about. Very difficult to focus your mind, because the situation is so sort of chaotic. You have to focus in a different way. You have to tune in to this deep, deep atmosphere that seems to be radiating from the Vajrasana, the spot where the Buddha gained enlightenment. And what I always find, I go there, you know, I've had it in mind, I'm going to the place where the Buddha gained enlightenment, and you know, I've been relating to this since I was 22. That's a long time now. I've been relating to this moment 3/4 of my life. And, sorry, exaggerating, I'm not that old. 2/3 of my life. And, although it seems like it sometimes. And, you know, I'm there at the place where it happened. So, there's this sort of a sense that it's not quite what you hoped it would be. Somehow one hoped the Buddha would be actually sitting there. And that one would sort of feel what he was feeling or something like that. It's actually just a noisy place with an old tree and a slab. And but if you look at it, if you look at that slab and you're sensing what happened, the absence of the Buddha makes a very powerful impact indeed. It's hard to explain this. But it's sort of more powerful than the presence of the Buddha. But the fact that the Buddha isn't there, that you cannot comprehend what happened to him on that spot, and that you're at the point where which passes your understanding. You're in the presence of something that is so majestic, so sublime, that you cannot encompass it with your understanding. And if you stay with that presence, so to speak, that absent presence, to get metaphorical about it, it gets you as close to the Buddha as I've ever been. The sense of the Buddha as not there, and therefore there. Do you see what I mean? By the absence of the Buddha, you are brought into what the Buddha was, what he is, in a sense. You come as close to him I come as close to him as I'll ever get. So that's my personal connection with the Buddha. He's the centre of my life. He's the source of the principles on which I base my life. He's the motivating force for my action. I do it in his service, at least when I remember to. I'm living on as a disciple of the Buddha, I try to keep the Buddha in mind as much as I possibly can, principally, as I say, through recognizing his absence. So I want to move slightly the picture I've been talking about Bodh Gaya now, what it's like now. But when I'm there, I always make an effort to remember what it would have been like 2,500 years ago and more. We know quite a bit about what Bodh Gaya would have been like, Uruvela, as it would have been called at that time. We know quite a bit about what it would have been like. For a start, right now, at this time, it is stinking hot. And I mean hot. I went and Googled and looked it up just now, and it was 45. That's pretty cool, actually. Bihar, over the next weeks, will get probably 47, 48. It'll be impossible. I went there in July last year, when the monsoon was supposed to have broken. And in fact, bits of rain were falling, but the rain was hot. The wonderful thing was there was nobody at the Mahabodhi temple. Everybody's too sensible to go there at that time. But it was really unpleasantly hot. I don't do very well in the heat. So you imagine the Buddha was there at approaching the hottest time of the year, the height of the Indian summer. And at that time, of course, no beggars, no village, no shops, nothing. It had just been jungle. When we say jungle, we all immediately think of, the rainforest, the Amazon jungle, or something like that. Jungle in much of northern India is not like that. It's by this time of year extremely dry. And in fact, in many places, leaves have fallen from trees. The teak leaves all fall off in the summer. This is sort of reverse process of our trees losing their leaves. So very, very dry, very hot. It's not lush vegetation at all. There would have been a lot of trees, part of the vast Mahavana, the great jungle, the great forests that covered the whole of India, in fact, at that time. It was in the bend of a river, the Naranjara River, which flows into the Ganges. It's a big river, huge river. But even when I was there in February, there's no water, so it's half a mile wide, maybe even a bit more than that, but no water at that time. When the rains come in June, July, August, it'll start to fill, and when water flows down from the hills, it'll start to fill. But at that time, when the Buddha was there, it was just sand, I assume. And this jungle, maybe with some tracks going through. There were apparently five villages in the area in Uruvela, in the little bend, or the big bend in the river, but they'd have been quite small at that time. They'd been very self-contained, just clearings in the jungle. The Ganges plain was to the north, around what is now Patna, Visipatana, which would have been, by that stage, beginning to be very wealthy. The central Indian Ganges plain was beginning to be very wealthy, and it's one of the factors in the rise of Buddhism, another story. But you imagine this very remote corner, just jungle, very little habitation, and the Buddha has been wandering for quite a number of years. He went forth, he left Kapilavastu, quite a long way to the north. He'd wandered through the jungle, begging in villages here and there, sometimes in town, spending some time at Rajgriha, which is 50, 60 kilometres to the north, and found his way to this remote corner. He'd been in some caves before this, the so-called Mahakala caves, where he'd practised extreme austerities, tapasya, in the great Indian tradition of mortifying the flesh in order to liberate the spirit. And he'd been following the teachings that he'd received from various, I'm going to say Hindu teachers, because of course Hinduism is a modern construction, but teachings in the ascetic tradition of spiritual practice alive at that time, very much alive and very, very heterodox and various. And he'd been practicing meditation, studying doctrine, studying the discussions about the nature of reality with various teachers, and he'd run out of road. He'd got to the point where he could not be convinced by anything that anybody taught him. And whatever he'd been taught, he'd achieved what they taught him it led to. He'd got there, and yet he'd felt there has to be more. It's not enough. It's not final. It's not the real thing. So he'd felt he must keep going. So by the time he comes to Bodh Gaya, he's a very lonely man. The people he'd been practicing with, the five ascetics who'd been his companions in extreme tapasya, when they saw him deserting that form of practice, they considered him to have returned to the low, in the immortal phrase of the canon, to have gone back to the ordinary life. You know, he starts to eat, blimey, softy. He was on his own, extremely lonely, but very, very difficult to come to a point where you cannot remain with people because they are not willing to accept that there's further to go, and that you must go further. Very, very difficult. Very difficult for us to do. We're very fortunate because we do belong to a sangha. But the Buddha had no sangha. The sangha he had belonged to had run out. Deserted him. It rejected him. Considered him to have been soft and turncoat, if you like. He had no teaching. He didn't know what to do. He couldn't get anybody to tell him the direction. So he's a lonely man. But at the same time, a very, very determined man. A man with a strong sense of what he must do, even though he didn't know what it was, if you see what I mean. A strong sense that he had to go further. Very, very determined. Very intent. And intense, I think. I imagine that if you'd seen him, you wouldn't have seen, you know, the nice sort of well-soigné image that we're usually presented with in Buddha images. It's okay that we're presented with him like that because it sort of indicates something else. He would have been fearsome. I think if we'd seen him, it would have been more like seeing, well, I remember Sangharakshita saying, more like seeing a shaman. He would have been dishevelled. He probably wouldn't have had a wash for quite a while. He would have been emaciated. He said that so great was his austerity that when he touched his belly, it was his backbone he grasped. He said that when he stroked his skin, his hair fell out. He was so famished, if you like. So he'd refused to give in to the needs of the body, and you see pictures of him at that stage. It's rather statues, some very famous statues of him, just a skeleton with skin covering and all the veins standing out, and his eyes deep set in his skull. So even though he'd rejected this life, he'd been on it for quite a long time. So by the time he came to Uruvela, he would have been emaciated, but at the same time extraordinarily intense. You can imagine his eyes like fire, deep set fire, blazing with intention, with purpose. And very, very focused, very mindful, very concentrated. Knowing what he must do, but not knowing where that would lead him. He'd had a sort of intuition that this path that he had been previously going down of extreme asceticism could only lead to one thing, death. He said that he was by that stage down to one grain of rice a day. And in the text he says, do not think that a grain of rice was any bigger then than it is now. Just to avoid doubt. He'd abandoned that. He'd realised that that was just a way to death. It didn't actually bring him closer to his goal, of liberation. Liberation from suffering. Solution to the deep sense of disquiet that that had driven him from the home life. And he'd remembered an incident that he had when he was a young boy. He remembered that he'd been with his father, in some accounts, in other accounts, been on his own, in the fields, while in some accounts his father was ploughing. There's all sorts of scholarly discussion about why a Maharaja would plough. And, endless PhDs have been gained on this subject. But the main thing is, he was sitting there under a jambu tree, big tree with lovely fruit, a sour sort of fruit, a bit like a gooseberry actually, sitting there under the tree and watching the plough going backwards and forwards. And must have been a beautiful day. He must have felt very peaceful and very relaxed, and maybe the action of the ploughman and the ox backwards and forwards, very soothing. I've done it many times myself. In fact, when I go to India just in 2 weeks' time, 3 weeks' time, I'll be seeing that, because they'll be getting ready for the monsoon, and there'll be the plough herds with a wooden plough still, a metal shoe, and two bullocks just pushing through the fields. They curse the oxen virulently, but you realise they love their bullocks. They really love them, and it's the cursing of one friend to another. To begin with, I thought they were terribly cruel, but then I realised just how much they love their oxen, their bullocks. But it's strangely soothing. If you're just sitting there, you just see that the soil just turning, and this beautiful colour of the soil turning, and in the shade of the tree, very peaceful, very still. Just the sound of the plough pulling through the earth. And he found himself, just completely without thinking about it, in a deeply relaxed and peaceful state. He felt completely at ease, very, very focused, but not focused in the muscular sense, but so relaxed that his mind was completely still and unmoving, not thinking about anything, not hungry, not thirsty, mentally, so to speak, just completely still, completely at peace, and very, very happy, but happy about nothing, completely content. And this experience came back to him at the end of this long period of intense quest, which every time that he dug the well and it had come up dry. He followed the road and it had run into the desert. He'd not got anywhere at all. And he just remembered this very simple childhood experience of peace. A very spontaneous, very natural, very innocent peace. Tranquility of mind. And it occurred to him that this was the way forward. The way forward wasn't with will. It wasn't with intense squeezing of the mind to the truth. It wasn't with the suppression of the body by depriving it of its nutrients so that it had barely enough strength for any sort of desire. It didn't lie in that direction either, because the mind has no strength either. And it didn't lie in these exalted, Vedantic and post-Vedantic and Upanishadic theories about the nature of things. It didn't lie there either. They were intellectual. They were theories. They didn't lead to experience. But this simple delightful experience of peace, of contentment, completely spontaneous, without any effort, just happening upon him. That was the way he knew. It's quite important for us, isn't it, that our Dhamma effort, yes, we have to make an effort, but we must never lose contact with the simple, almost childlike pleasure of just sitting there, just being. No striving, no effort, just allowing something to unfold from within us. And he sought a place where he could pursue this. And he found a great people tree, Ficus religiosa, a Bodhi tree, beautiful, great trees with spreading branches and these heart-shaped leaves hanging down, the long pendant at the end of the leaf. Very beautiful tree, which grows anywhere, fascinating. They particularly like to grow in walls. And they're very, very good for shade, because they spread so far and the leaves are quite thick. So it's a very good place for him to sit. It's got a nice, firm trunk, so you can put your back against it, as it were. And while he was there, a goat maiden came by with her herd of goats, and she, seeing him there in the great Indian tradition of hospitality and reverence for people who are practicing a serious spiritual life of any kind, she milked her goats, gave him some rice with the milk mixed into it, and he took that as his first real refreshment, giving him strength and flooding energy back into his body. And another herdsman came by, and he was carrying a bundle of grass, kusa grass, and he saw the Buddha sitting there, and he said, "Let me make a seat for you." And he piled up the grass under the tree to make the Buddha comfortable, and they went off, and he was left alone. And he sat there, reconnected with that experience of peace, of tranquility, of natural mind, not forced mind, not extreme mind, not bifurcated mind, natural mind just at rest, at peace. And on the basis of that natural mind, he began to examine his experience. Examine's too forcible, isn't it? He began to notice what's going on within him and around him. He paid attention, but very, very relaxed, not thinking, not forcing his mind, just allowing his mind to rest on what was going on. The process is moving within him. The process is moving around him. And he meditated all night, and well, he'd said before he sat down, "I'm going to sit here, and may my flesh wither, may my blood dry up, I will not move until I've attained what I want to attain." So he had that sort of determination, but then to sit there in a relaxed way, there's this combination of it, determination with very open, relaxed attention to what is going on. But it's said that as the morning star rose in the east, the planet Venus rose in the east, he awakened. He recognized, he realized that everything that arises in dependence on conditions. That everything that arises in dependence on conditions, it will fade. You got it? That's what he realised. Well, that's his attempt to communicate to us later what he realised. What he realised didn't have words. He just saw. And what he saw set him free. It set him free. From then on, nothing could trouble him. Whatever happened to him outside didn't bother him. Nothing arose within him that disturbed him. It wasn't just that for a moment he was at peace, you know, like you come to the class and you sit and you get the moment of peace in the mindfulness of breathing or the metta, and then it's gone. Because we haven't understood fully the basis of things. But when the Buddha saw what he saw, and we can't really say what he saw, when he saw what he saw, his tranquility was eternal. It was unshakable. He couldn't be moved. It was impossible, because what could be moved was no longer there, if you see what I mean. The sense of a quest for an identity, the quest for who I am, had gone. He'd seen through it. He'd seen there's no need for it. In all our lives, we're seeking who we are. We're trying to be something. We're trying to be something in relation to other people. We're trying to identify ourselves. So much of our energy goes in reconstructing and reconstructing who we are. And of course, it's a doomed activity, because reality is constantly denying our self-identifications. The Buddha stopped. Just stopped. Completely at peace. He realized there's no need for it. You can simply be without that. And everything unfolds. All good qualities come into being. All good qualities come into existence. Just naturally, readily, spontaneously, you could say, unfolding once you've made that break. So the Buddha sat there under the Bodhi tree, experiencing, it said, the bliss of liberation. The bliss of liberation. Oh, may it come. The bliss of liberation. You know, this is the thing. Nothing to do. Nowhere to go. Nothing to be. Nothing to strive for. It's all here. It's all been achieved. It's all been done. And nothing has been done. Everything is fulfilled. There's no further striving. That's what he felt. And it blissful. The bliss of release. Quite important, isn't it? Because we can easily identify the Buddha with a sort of neutrality, a kind of negative, or an absence of unpleasant things. And we forget that his experience was the bliss of release, sitting there just filled with peace, with joy, with release. Release is a wonderful term, isn't it? Release. You know, you've been confined, you've been imprisoned, you've been limited, you've been cramped. Suddenly release. You're out. So experiencing that bliss of release. So he sat there for 7 days continuously. 7 days, you know. Don't take it too literally. Seven is always a mystical number. In fact, we're told that he spent 7 times 7 days in the vicinity of the Bodhi tree. I'm sure that this indicates something to us, but I'm not sure that a CCTV camera would have caught it. But yes, he's sitting there just glorying in what's happened to him. And various experiences come to him after that. It's not complete, because what he achieved at that moment was more like passing through a door. It's sometimes spoken of as we sometimes speak of vimoksha mukha, the doorway to liberation, vimoksha. So he passed through the door to liberation. Through that door, it's not that everything stops. Again, it's not that there's a big blank and nothing goes on. Dreadful, wouldn't it, if we were striving for a big blank? There are easier ways of doing it, I assure you. Once you're through there, everything sort of turns inside out. And it begins to unfold. And unfold in new and more magical and rich ways, more creative ways, more beautiful ways. I've been on a retreat on the theme of beauty. And beauty is a very important quality in the Dhamma. And the Buddha's experience was an experience of intense beauty. Beauty even in the midst of suffering. And an intense response to that suffering. Response of compassion to that suffering. So this extraordinary what do fountains do? Cascade of a new and different kind of experience of emotions, but beyond emotion, thoughts, but beyond thought, volitions, but beyond volition as we know it. So much more integrated, so much more whole, just unfolding into new and unimaginable dimensions, which we get some intimations of in our ordinary experience. Our ordinary experience of beauty is an intimation of the beauty that the Buddha experiences. Our experience of Maitri or Metta is an intimation of the Metta and Karuna that the Buddha experiences. Our experience of understanding is an intimation of the wisdom that the Buddha experiences. So we're shown the Buddha over the next, sometimes it's said 5 weeks, sometimes 7 weeks, going through a set of experiences, which I have talked about here on this platform before, but yes, I won't go into them now. You imagine him, he's nobody told him what he was going to experience. Nobody knew what was going to happen. According to Buddhist tradition, this had never happened before in human history. He'd gone where no human being had gone before. A giant step for etc. So he's discovering it all for himself. You get wonderful little intimations in suttas all the way through the Pali Canon of what happened to him at that time. Sometimes he's reporting much later what happened to him at that time, telling people how he experienced things, what happened to him. And I just want to, I've talked so much as usual that I've not left myself time to do what I principally aimed to do. So I'll just glance at it. I wanted to talk about a particular experience that he had, according to most traditions, late traditions, in the fifth week after his enlightenment. He'd sort of stroll around through the jungle in that immediate vicinity, sitting under different trees and sort of exploring different areas of his new experience, of his new mind. Well, not his mind, of mind itself. He'd explore it in different ways, different aspects of it, sometimes trying to discover how to express it, how to communicate it. But in the fifth week, he sat under a tree which is a particular sort of favourite spot of mine. If you go to Bodh Gaya, when you come down the big steps to the level of the Mahabodhi temple, there's a big pillar at the bottom, right at the bottom of the steps, with a rather unaesthetic sign, AS, Archaeological Survey of India sign, next to it, saying this is the Ajapala Nigrodha, the goat herd's banyan tree. And it's delightful because many pilgrims, when they come there, they worship that sign. Which, fair enough, why not? The pillar is supposed to be on the spot where the tree was. That's the proper place to worship. Joke. What took place there is very, very interesting, because it's where the Buddha really began first to consider other people. And up until now, the experience had been sort of unfolding within him, if you like. If I said the Buddha was blown away, that would be probably Lay's Majesty or whatever that would be in Sanskrit. It sort of almost belittles what happened. But he's entering a whole new area where he has no vocabulary, no guidelines, nobody to draw on. At this point, he encounters a human being, he encounters a wandering Brahmin who asks him various questions, and it's very interesting in its own right, and that's a whole other talk, I won't go into that now. but it really amounts to what we think of in India as the launching of the Dhamma revolution, the revolution against the hierarchical fossilized or ossified social system, which we've got here as well. And he rejects it outright, and asserts moral qualities as the measure of worth, not birth and wealth, social position. He also confronts the issue of you know, what to do, whether to try to tell anybody about it. This is where he had the famous sense that he couldn't teach, that what he'd seen was so different from what everybody else wanted and what they could understand. There was nothing he could say to anybody. Thank goodness for us here today, he realised that no, people were in different stages of development and some could understand. But what I want to just briefly dwell on, just to bring it to your minds for its personal reference, he also started to think, I think I'm at the top of what human beings can be. There's nobody I can look up to. I can't look up to anybody as a moral exemplar because I'm completely ethically pure myself. I can't look to anybody for as an exemplar or teacher of meditation. I've explored fully what is possible to explore in meditation. I can't look to anybody for wisdom. I've already discovered that. And he said that I want something to look up to. It's the Buddha. The Buddha. I want something to look up to. He says, to live without reverence and reliance is painful and sorrowful. To live without reverence and reliance is painful and sorrowful. Even for the Buddha. If you don't have something to look up to, something to rely on, it's painful. I think it's extremely pertinent, especially to our Western culture. Of course, there are very many different versions of Western culture, even present in this room. But it's something that really strikes me in India. People are still not ashamed of reverence. You know, one doesn't always approve of what they revere, and one might question what they revere, but they don't mind revering. They like revering. They enjoy revering. They do it with pleasure and often with great delicacy and sensitivity, even if one might question the objects of reverence. What we have in our postmodern culture here, and of course it's different for different people, different backgrounds and so on, but certainly from my background, a tremendous debunking of any sense of reverence. Because we've rebelled against false hierarchies, the whole of our history since really the 17th century is a history of the tearing down of false political ideologies and even false religious ideologies, and the tearing down of the revering and obedience to authority. Which is good. I'm all for that. But with it, there's a danger that we lose something. Because to be without reverence, to be without reliance, something that you can look up to, something that you can respect, is painful. Why is it painful? Because you're just left with you. Or rather, me. I'm just left with me. And I know me, it's not worth being left with me. I'm left with me a lot of the time. And, you know, I'm pretty good. I have my good moments and so on. But if it was all just me that I could rely on, it'd be a pretty dismal world. I strongly advise you against it. Even in your own case, wonderful as you are, dear audience, don't rely only on yourself. Yes, rely on yourself morally. Rely on your own moral integrity. Take responsibility for your own moral actions, but revere what is worthy of reverence. If we do not have reverence in our lives, if we cannot look up to something, our lives are shallow, narrow, and painful. I've mentioned this often. My epitome of this is a modern Mal. Or is it Mall? I can never remember how we pronounce it. I used to go with my mother when I took her out in her wheelchair at the end of her life. I'd take her out with her wheelchair with her stick. Most of my attention was on her stick because she had a habit of whacking beautiful young men on the bottom. apart from being attentive to my aged mother's naughtiness, wickedness, she's from New Zealand, so Maitri Vadri will know all about that. Watch her. What I knew tonight is a terrible, terrible dampening of the spirit of the whole setting. The cheapy, cheerful setting. The sense that to buy was to win the lottery of life. That if you bought the right products and enough of them at the right shop, in the right peak of fashion and so forth, that was nirvana. Dreadful, oppressive. I used to feel almost physically sick inside them. And very glad when my mother got fed up and wanted to go home. Usually pretty much as we got in before we'd done the shopping. Oppressive environment. You know, of course, they're very convenient. You can buy goods, and we're very lucky that we live at a time when more people, at least in our country, have access to more of the benefits of the world than at any time at that level. But the lack of any upward gaze, of anything to revere, anything to look up to, and you know, you so often find a Buddha image in a shop window as an advertising icon. Or other, you know, you find a, you know, Botticelli painting used as an advertising cliche, or you know, the Largo from the double violin concerto used as an advertisement for cigars. God, that dates me. You know, that the greatest used simply in the service of the lowest. It's okay on its own level, but we lose the sense of something to revere, something to look up to. Even the Buddha felt the need to revere. And I think that is extraordinarily salutary. And each of us needs to ask, what do we revere? What do we look up to? What are the ideals? What are the values that we look up to, that we worship even? And if we bow down in front of the Buddha, for instance, it's not that we're bowing to a graven idol or whatever. We're bowing to the ideals, the values that the Buddha embodies. If we worship the Dhamma, it's because the Dhamma embodies the values that we live by. If we worship the Sangha, it's the ideal of what a human community could be that we're worshipping, not a mundane order or whatever. So what do we revere? What do we rely on as a source of real confidence in our lives, reliable confidence? Well, the Buddha said that the only thing that he could revere and rely upon was the Dhamma. It was through realizing the Dhamma, realizing the truth, realizing the way things really are, that he had awakened. He'd awoken to the truth of things. So he would revere and rely upon that truth, rely upon the Dhamma. But we shouldn't think of the Dhamma as you know, just a pile of books, or as a Dhamma talk, or as a practice of meditation, or a set of postulates, or anything like that. We should think of the Dhamma as a living principle, something you can actually feel, something you can almost taste, as something more approached as an object of beauty than as an object of understanding. Well, there is an object of understanding as well. It's not an object, of course, because it's beyond subject and object. But the Dhamma is a living principle that informs our lives, that is active within our lives. It's more like a spirit or force or larger awareness, which our own awareness aspires to and participates in, and at its best aligns itself with. That is what the Buddha revered and relied upon. So having explored a little my own relationship with the Buddha and how I came to connect with the Buddha, and a little about the Buddha's own experience at that time, the history of the historical situations, tried to recreate that as best I can, and what he actually experienced, we're left with this image of what he revered. And what he revered, we can revere. We can revere the Dhamma as a living principle, a force even, to use a metaphor, a principle that is active, not an impersonal principle, a personal, even suprapersonal principle that can inform and guide our lives and that we can rely upon. Without losing our moral integrity, we can revere and rely upon the Dhamma. This is the message of the Buddha from under that tree, the Ajapala Nigrodha tree. So I hope that my Dhamma Day talk, I've connected you a little bit with the Buddha, certainly with my impression of the Buddha, my experience of the Buddha, and hopefully we've all come to feel a little bit more closely what it was that happened on that occasion that we're commemorating today. This extraordinary experience in human history, in human civilization. For me, as a committed Buddhist, it's the most important event of human history, from which all history has unfolded. And it's that history that we aim to act in pursuit and pursuance of. So thank you very much.
I feel I've been in the presence of an inspired outpouring about the Buddha and his life and the relevance of the Buddha to us in our lives at the moment. I really feel you kind of evoked the time around the Bodhi tree very, very vividly. Very, very vividly. And gave us an insight, well, both into your own personal connection with the Buddha, gave us an insight into the conditions that the Buddha was living in, but very sort of boldly shone a light into the conditions that we find ourselves in now, and kind of the relevance and the meaning of the Buddha's life in our lives as we live here today. So very, very sort of powerful talk. I really want to thank you very much for just sort of spontaneously uttering that being here and doing the Buddha Day talk. So thank you very much, Spooty.